and welcome back to Regionally Speaking. I'm your host, Dee Dotson, along with Tom Maloney. The results of the 2024 general election left some voters sharing hopes as well as fears for democracy. Across the Hoosier states, as well as across the country, some frame this election as both democracy and hyperbole on the ballot. As Republicans across the country saw victory breaking the blue wall all the way up to the White House, in the days and weeks leading up to the election, many have begun to question what's next for our country and our democracy. Leanne Hoka is an attorney, the co-founder of Hoosier Women Forward, as well as the board president for Our Choice Coalition, and she joins us now to talk more about what the Democratic Party needs to do to regain its members. Leanne, thank you so much for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me.
Leanne, it is a pleasure to have you join us today on Regionally Speaking as we prepare for a new administration at the State House as well as at the White House. The GOP will have a supermajority at the State House, and Republicans won control of the House of Representatives as well. These wins will seemingly make it easier for President-elect Donald Trump to enact his agenda, and I would surmise that the same can be said about Mike Braun, a Republican, the newly elected governor of the Hoosier State. The issues that mattered most as we headed to the polls were the economy, immigration, and for many across the country during the most recent election cycle, including here in Indiana, a red state, abortion. And that's why I wanted to have you here with us today. By trade, you are an attorney, but you're also a staunch women's rights advocate, and you are the co-founder of Hoosier Women Forward. And again, you are the board president for Our Choice Coalition. Now, before we take a deep dive into what you believe the Democratic Party will need to do to rebrand to win back its members, take a moment to share more about the advocacy work you do.
Yeah, sure. So I am actually, my day job is a bankruptcy attorney. I do Chapter 13 bankruptcy work for Trustee Ann Delaney in the Southern District of Indiana. But I have done a couple of nonprofits. I'm most proud of starting Hoosier Women Forward, which is a political action committee nonprofit that is dedicated to running a leadership training program for Democratic women across the state of Indiana, and have had much success. I'm no longer on that board. I am a proud co-founder, and I've spent some time with the Indiana Democratic Party as the 5th District Congressional Chair after Trump was elected for those 4 years. And I spend some of my time now running as chair of a political action committee that I'm most excited about that formed right after Roe fell and continued to operate even as Indiana was the first out of the gate to ban abortion post-Roe. And we are dedicated to electing candidates for state and local office in Indiana who will fight to promote and prioritize Hoosiers' rights and access to reproductive health care, including abortion. So this is really our first cycle at Our Choice Coalition to target some legislative races. As you know, there's really not too many competitive races in Indiana anymore due to gerrymandering, which I can talk about a little bit later. But we didn't have any wins. As you know, the House didn't pick up any pro-choice candidates in Indiana on election night. However, the candidates that we did target that put abortion kind of as a centerpiece of their campaign really did buck the national trends and break through some of that national noise and got a lot closer and outperformed the top of the Democratic ticket even when Trump was successful in those districts. So I'm excited to share that, but it was a really, really tough night in Indiana having Trump at the top of the ballot.
I did want to say this because in preparing for my conversation today, I did a little bit of digging into your background, and I found a quote that was quite interesting. I know you're no longer on the board for Hoosier Women Forward, but I found it quite interesting that when you were asked about the start of this organization, you said, "Don't ask permission, just do it." Share a little bit about that, because I believe that will inspire a lot of women here in the region.
Sure. You know, I think that there are political party rules and structures in place. And I think as both the Republican and Democratic Party have seen, sometimes they don't particularly serve the progress that you're trying to make. And so there was at times a bit of pushback that this women's leadership training program had started. But really that quote comes from the woman that advice from a woman that started the Lugar series, which is the Republican leadership training program that we modeled ourselves after. She gave me that advice after Trump was elected in 2016, when we were trying to figure out what could be done to kind of push back on what had just happened. And well, we chose, you know, deliberately not to do it through the Democratic Party, although the women that we choose are certainly progressive women that adhere to the same values we believe in. But, you know, it was for someone that's used to following rules, it was hard to do that without asking permission. But I really got that good advice from a Republican friend and colleague.
Leanne, I alluded to this at the start of our conversation, that you are a women's reproductive rights advocate with Our Choice Coalition, and you have strong views on what the overturning of Roe v. Wade meant for women, particularly here in the Hoosier State. Again, I know this is a hot button issue for many of our listeners, but I just have to ask you, and I'm just going to get right into it. Do you believe a second Trump presidency will decimate women's sexual and reproductive health, not only in the Hoosier State, but across the country?
I think that Trump administration is scared. They're scared to do anything in a major sweeping way. What you are going to see is what we've seen with abortion rights and reproductive health care for the past couple of decades, and that is, you know, death by a thousand cuts. It's just going to be one little thing here and there, and they really are likely going to work through state legislatures and they'll also try to do some things on the federal, now that they think they have a mandate and they control all branches of government. They will try to pass things that will roll back even further reproductive rights. And, you know, I think about our friends in the blue states that have worked so hard to protect reproductive health care, and those states that have passed constitutional protections for reproductive health care, including access to abortion. And I think about them and wonder what is next and what the federal government might do. But I don't want that to be a distraction from what is going to continue to happen in the other states. Because we saw, you know, I will say Our Choice Coalition did a poll back in May, Indiana statewide poll. And we engaged in this poll to try to figure out how to message on abortion in Indiana. We had a sense based on some other national polls and a few others that were done in Indiana that Indiana really, the Hoosier voters really weren't in favor of a abortion ban and the reversal of Roe v. Wade. And so we went into it to figure out how to talk about it and message it. What we came out with was something really, really, really shocking. And that is 4 out of 10 voters did not know we had a near total abortion ban in Indiana. And so we knew we had this education piece problem that we had to deal with first before we even figured out how to message appropriately on this issue across the state. And it's not one size fits all. The way you talk about abortion is very different in different parts of the state. Mm. And a lot of it, and I can talk about this later, but a lot of that is because of the news, where people get their information from. And so what we found out is even the Republicans that had banned abortion, those that had voted against any exceptions for rape or incest, were just not bragging about it. They weren't talking about it in some of these areas. And so we kind of had to work with our candidates to make sure that they knew that you needed to educate people first, because, we were just so surprised to know that a lot of people did not know that we banned abortion. And so I think one of the challenges we had this year was that the Trump campaign really walked back their position on abortion. We know, you know, behind the scenes, Trump was probably making all sorts of promises to Right to Life people that he would continue to expand restrictions on reproductive health care access. But publicly, he wasn't saying much. And all he was saying is, I'm not in favor of a national abortion ban. Well, that's quite convenient when most of these states have already taken these actions to ban abortion. Mm-hmm. And there's things he can do, like restrict and limit access to birth control, continue to pump federal money into pregnancy crisis centers that are advocating for women not to have abortions and not telling them the full picture of healthcare and what that can look like for them. And so, you know, it was very strategic. And I think you if you could take exit polling, a lot of people that voted for Trump felt that they weren't necessarily voting against their own interests because, and I say their own interests because like 80-some percent of Hoosier voters are not in favor of Indiana's near total abortion ban. And so he knew that. He knew it wasn't a popular issue, and he and J.D. Vance definitely walked that back continuously during their campaigning.
So I want to pivot for a moment. So earlier this year, data from the Pew Research Center showed the partisan identification of registered voters was evenly split between the two major parties. 49% of registered voters are Democrats, or they lean to the Democratic Party, and nearly an identical share Republican or lean to the Republican Party. And that's in stark contrast to 5% more of American voters identifying as Democrats over Republicans in 2020. Now, in the months, weeks, and days leading up to and during the 2024 general election, because you mentioned exit polls reflected that many accused the Democratic Party of alienated its identified members, largely over some of the key issues that we have been discussing. You are the former 5th District Chair of the Indiana Dems, and I want to talk to you about the future of the Democratic Party. I have seen, and I'm sure you have seen it, story after story after story, stating that Democrats are in fact in a full-blown identity crisis. What is your position on this take of the party?
You know, I see it more as a crisis in strategy because I've been following the Republican strategy and exercises for a long time now. And, you know, their views and values and beliefs, and you can, any polling or anything will show this, that they don't, their values and beliefs, you know, banning abortion, getting rid of Obamacare, that just doesn't match what the public wants. So there's this big mismatch here. And so a lot of this polling is really depends on how you ask the questions. But the Democratic brand has taken a beating, but it's not because the values they stand for are misaligned with the values of Americans. It's truly, I really believe this, it's because of misinformation that is out there. I think that one of the things the Democratic Party nationally or in Indiana can do is really try to figure out, if it's not too late, figure out how to develop a serious strategic robust media infrastructure to fight this, incredible right-wing news propaganda that in some cases, you know, I noticed in following some of this media, oftentimes it seems that a lot of the content that was coming into the Trump campaign actually came from an idea in the right-wing news media. So it's almost like that structure existed first and then, you know, kind of used Donald Trump as the messenger and what they were trying to accomplish. I read once that Viktor Orban told the CPAC in 2022, have your own media. And I think that is what we're seeing in real time play out. It's been in the works for quite some time. This right-wing media that has carried his candidacy in 2016 and in 2024, and it's not going away. In fact, you're starting to see some shifts too, where other news media, you know, what we think of more mainstream news media outlets are taken over by some of the right-wing media conglomerates. And this is very, very dangerous for democracy in the United States. And the Democratic Party has got to try to figure out how to build back and fight some of this misinformation and meet people where they are, because our candidates and our campaigns are not getting to the people that need to hear what we have to say. Because once they do, and they hear it in a way that resonates, they're very much aligned with Democratic ideals and policies. The problem is truly, I believe, the misinformation that is out there coming from the right-wing news media.
You know, this just occurred to me. You mentioned earlier, we have just about 2 minutes or so left, but you mentioned earlier the role that gerrymandering played in all of that. Did you want to kind of unpack that a little bit?
Yeah. So unfortunately, another challenge that Indiana Democrats have, it's not unique just to Indiana, but some states have protections against gerrymandering, or they have a bipartisan redistricting commission or something, or their own legislators don't draw their own district lines. In Indiana, the legislature draws their own district lines. And, you know, you've seen the past couple of cycles when Democrats won statewide, their baseline is at least 40%. We do not even have 40% in the House of seats. There's 30% of the seats right now currently, and the Democrats have to fight for those, you know, just to get to 30%, and are fighting, still fighting to try to just break the supermajority. And then you've got on the Senate side in Indiana, even worse, it's like 18% are Democratic seats due to gerrymandering. I mean, I think the fact, and we can't go to the courts. The courts are seeming to say we're not going to get involved with the you know, will of the legislature, but you know, something has to be done because this is a huge structural barrier for Indiana Democrats. And then the other thing is, in addition to gerrymandering, where there's hardly any competitive seats across the state of Indiana, we are one of the only states that doesn't have direct ballot access or initiative. And so we can't even take these values or issues to directly to the people, because we don't have that right in our laws or in our constitution. And actually, when Our Choice Coalition did a poll back in May, we also asked about that question, and everybody wants to have, everyone thinks we should have a right to direct ballot access or initiative. And so these are just a couple of the structural barriers which really put Democrats at a disadvantage, skew the election results. So it appears that we are much more of a conservative state than we are. And I have to say too, if you look at Indiana demographics compared to Wisconsin, we are a very, very similar state. We have about similar number of union membership, similar number of rural, urban, suburban divide, a very similar number of non-college educated white voters. The difference is, you know, Wisconsin, well, first of all, I think Wisconsin Democrats have had a strategic plan for quite some time now. The Democratic Party needs to build its own strategic plan using data so we can figure out where these trends and opportunities are, where do we need to turn out the vote, and where do we need to stop the bleeding. But they also don't have as bad of a gerrymandering problem. And the fact that Democrats can't, there's no chance of winning in a vast majority of the states is really, really undemocratic. And I think it's something most people in this state don't quite understand.
Leanne, before I let you go, I just have to ask you, because, again, Democrats are continuing to lose the working class whites, and now exit polls show that blue-collar Latinos and some black men,
long a core part of the Democratic base, are abandoning the party.
Do Democrats need to do anything else to become relevant to supporters?
You know, I would not advise Democrats to change their values. They have to change their strategy. They've got to start trying to figure out how to win back non-college educated white voters. But it doesn't mean you have to get, you know, you have to throw out your values. Look at on the Republican side, you've got people that were very staunchly pro-choice that were going out and voting for Trump. They have got to increase their brand such that they are, and fight back against that national right-wing media noise. To communicate to people what the truth is and what they actually stand for and why their policies are the best policies. But it's going to take a lot of work. We're still trying to understand exactly where that work needs to be. But I would just caution people that are saying Democrats need to shift more to the center, because I think you don't have to let go of your values, but it's how you message, and it's where you go and where you meet, and you have to meet these voters where they are. We cannot continue to assume that everybody's listening to the same news stations, and we've got to break through into those communities, especially the rural communities.
Leanne Holka is an attorney based in Indianapolis and is the co-founder of Hoosier Women Forward, as well as the board president for Our Choice Coalition. Leanne, again, thank you so much for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media.
Joining us now on the studio line is Northwest Indiana business reporter and local author Joseph Pete to discuss his latest book, Lost East Chicago and Indiana Harbor. Joe, welcome back to Regionally Speaking.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
As I flip through the book here that we got to our studios just a few days ago, I was really, really taken back, I think, by just the amount of stories that can be told about East Chicago and the Indiana Harbor. What gave you the idea to go ahead and collect all these stories and put them into the form of a book?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, so I had read in Lost Time in Indiana for the History Press previously, and they have a Lost series of books. Jerry Davich with the Times also wrote Lost Gary, but they have books like this for cities all over the country. They had asked me to do another book about Northwest Indiana, and initially I was thinking about doing a book about the steel mills, which I've covered extensively. And I was starting to do, over the years, everyone said, I got a lot of suggestions over, like, what my next book should be. People know I like to write about the history. I got a lot of suggestions for Chicago over the years, so that was kind of in the back of my mind. Mm-hmm. But I initially started researching a book about the steel mills and I was doing some research at the Chicago Public Library. But I was just struck by all the stories of the community, everything that was just notable about the community. Hearing these stories about, the warm, nostalgic feelings people have about growing up in Indiana Harbor. I mean, although the city does have some urban problems like pollution and political corruption and things like that, people just have a very, just a glowing sense of, like, what it was like to grow up in such a diverse place with so many different nationalities from all over the world, where different languages and different cuisines are served on every block, and people are just kind of, like, united. Everyone's dad, worked at the steel mill. Everyone was kind of on the same footing. It kind of like really brought together people and gave people a sense of camaraderie. And I was just really struck by that and impressed by that. So I kind of pivoted away from doing a book about, I plan to revisit that later, but I pivoted away from doing a book about just the steel mills and decided to write about one of the steel towns. And, there's so much about East Chicago is just fascinating. I really view it as a microcosm of America. It's where people came from all over the world to pursue opportunity. You had, you had over 100 nationalities at one point. They, built up mighty steel mills there that just drew people, from all over the world. It was, a lot of families' first entrance into America. And its fortunes kind of right rose and fell with the steel mills. But it was just this incredible melting pot that people still tell a lot of stories about.
Joe, where is the Indiana Harbor for folks who either A, have never been there, or B, maybe they're not here in Northwest Indiana listening to this conversation today?
Oh, sure, absolutely. East Chicago is known as the Twin City. It is not like a Twin Cities like Minneapolis or St. Paul are two separate cities. It's two distinct neighborhoods in the same city, but originally they had a very different character. There was, they're basically separated. You had the Indiana Harbor portion where it's on Lake Michigan. It's near where the Cleveland Cliffs Works steel mill is. It's kind of built around that. It's between Klein but it's separated from the traditional Indiana Harbor portion of the city, which they're only accessible by a couple different roads. They're divided by the ship canal and the railroad lines. And they were initially like two very different parts. Indiana Harbor part was traditionally where a lot of the immigrants would locate. It was close to the steel mills. There was a little bit more pollution. It was a little more dense and more urban. A lot more housing, like on the same block. The traditional East Chicago part was a little bit more suburban in character. That's where like City Hall is. It's Main and Indianapolis Boulevard. The city does have two downtowns, but people think of the East Chicago downtown as the one with Casablanca, City Hall and the bomb shop and so forth. And that was historically it was kind of the more sort of genteel suburban area was the East Chicago proper. And for a long time, one of the things my book explores is they had the great Roosevelt-Washington divide the two sides were, the two sides each had their high school. They had a big basketball rivalry. The basketball was like everything in the community. It was the place to be on Friday night. They produced a lot of it was the only city in the state where they had back-to-back undefeated national champions from two different high schools. it's the only city in the entire country where they had two players who were both played in both the Final Four and in the World Series. It produced like a lot of great athletes: Junior Bridgman, Greg Popovich, Tim Stoddard, just a ton of people, and largely it was kind of honed by that. That rivalry. It was one of the great basketball cities in Indiana for a long time, and many people are nostalgic about, you know, Hale Noble Washington or Roosevelt, or depending on which side of the city they were from. So it was a friendly rivalry, but it was there was a definitely strong sense of identity depending on where in the city you grew up in, where you went to high school, and it partly reflected kind of those class and ethnic divides and so forth.
Speaking of basketball, and I should note really quick, you've got like five straight chapters dedicated to Washington, Roosevelt, Washington, Roosevelt, Washington. So if that tells you anything about the rivalry there, Michael Jordan makes a mention in your book as well in chapter 23. I don't want to give away the full story, of course, but why is Michael Jordan in a book about East Chicago?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, he played his first game in a Bulls uniform at Washington High School. He was the city had recruited the Bulls to play a preseason game because Ulysses Bridgman was playing for the Bucks at the time, and he was a big hometown star, and they're looking to host a Bucks Bulls game. It was just a basketball crazed town at the time, still too. But they arranged to have the Bulls come in and to play. So the first time he ever suited up was for the Bulls was in East Chicago, and he was very stellar. He got in a couple dunks. I interviewed several people who were there. They kind of recounted their memories. With my previous history book, a lot of it was kind of focused on, you know, the primary sources, newspaper articles, you know, whatever I could dig up from the archives. This has all that too. Old Inland, you know, magazines and things of that nature. But this book is heavily based on interviews with people who grew up in and lived in East Chicago and Indiana Harbor, and kind of sharing their memories of, special occasions like the Jordan's first game with the Bulls. And one thing that I was surprised in researching it was just how many sort of notable people either hailed from East Chicago, mm-hmm. where, I mean, you have like the ABC newsman, Frank Reynolds, or Phil Ponce, the great television journalist, or, you know, the Medal of Honor winning Emilio De La Garza, a lot of firsts in the state with, the first, Latino elected official, the first Latino company, the longest running Latino company in the Midwest, things of that nature. But then you also had a lot of great people that had some kind of connection to the city, like Stevie Wonder spent part of childhood growing up there. The Jackson family, before they moved to Gary, they lived in East Chicago. There was a lot of notable people have some connection. It was, it produced people like Betsy Palmer, who played, most known today for playing Jason Voorhees' mother in Friday the 13th. But she was like a major actor who was known for all her television and movie roles and the golden age of Hollywood. And it was the city, it was a difficult life in the city for many because it was long hours in the steel mills. It was hard work. It was, but it managed to kind of forge a lot of like greatness and just all kinds of different endeavors, whether science fiction books or athletics or art or tattooing. You had the first tattoo shop founded in Chicago, started by an East Chicagoan. There was just so much. East Chicago people have just gone on to accomplish so much in the world.
So, along with all of those famous names, one famous name that actually isn't a person, of course, is the Titanic. And correct me if I'm wrong, Joe, the Titanic never actually set sail in Lake Michigan, and of course, it sunk in the Atlantic Ocean. So, what tie does the Titanic have to East Chicago?
Oh, absolutely. That's a great. It's like the Unsalted, where they point out there's like Michigan's still shark free. But there was a tragic connection to it where there was a resident who sailed over on the Titanic to East Chicago, and he was he sailed over with his sister and his sister's child, and the sister and the child didn't make it. He did survive, but he went on to live in East Chicago with his family. They sailed over from Sweden, I believe. But it was just it's just remarkable. I just found when researching it, like how much history has some sort of East Chicago connection. But it was it was one of the many East Chicago immigration stories where they were in they were coming over from Sweden and they just happened to pick the worst possible boat. And he would tell stories about it to his family for the rest of his life. And it was just unfortunate that he made it, but his rest of his family did not.
Really a tragic story there. But there, again, a lot of stories talking, like you said, about Catherine Holm, talking about the East Chicago Hermit, learning all about, of course, the slice of life, along with parades and holiday parties. The Pastrick Machine, of course, that's in reference to former East Chicago Mayor Robert Pastrick, who was in charge for decades and really kind of the main cog in the machine, if you will, with regards to what we know as the Democratic machine. What kind of a role did Pastrick play, not only on East Chicago politics, but region politics as a whole?
Oh, absolutely. Well, Pastrick even had like a national influence. He was kind of considered like a kingmaker at times. Anytime like Robert Kennedy or some notable politician would pass through, they would, they'd have to pay a visit to Pastrick. Because for a long time, East Chicago was the center of the Democratic Party in, Lake County. It was kind of considered you were either from East Chicago or you wanted to be. And it was kind of the center of power, partly because of the machine politics. But that was one thing about the one thing that was notable about the book. There have been other like great books about, Archibald McKinley wrote Twin City. Dame Anderson wrote East Chicago for Arcadia Publishing. There have been many good books about East Chicago. It's been a while since it's been a general purpose one. But the city is so rich with stories. Like, you could literally just do a book about the politics. You could do a book about the pollution. You could do a book about all these different intersecting issues. It would be worthy of, like, books on their own. But Pastrick was, he was the subject of documentaries like The King of Steel Town. And he was, subject to scrutiny from the FBI and federal officials for years and years. And he was never convicted, but he was finally brought down by the sidewalk scandal in which multiple city officials ended up being convicted of basically selling paving of sidewalks and sidewalk repairs for vote, exchanging them for votes. And it brought down a lot of people. One of the councilmen fled to Greece, where his family was from, and they have no extradition policy if he happens to be of Greek ancestry. And he's still there now, unless he passed away. But they were known for, it was a big vote center in the state back, and it was also big in the state at the time when a lot of statewide elections used to be more competitive. Indiana had governors like Frank O'Bannon and Evan Bayh and so forth. And Pastrick was respected throughout the state and turned to throughout the state for being able to drive turnout. In East Chicago, obviously, but in Lake County. And it was kind of that Chicago-style machine politics where they would, bring out the numbers. And he ruled for decades and decades and made all kinds of change in the city. But he did things to kind of safeguard the city for the future, bringing in the casino and the marina and all kinds of different developments. Is kind of the steel job faded, but politics are a big part of the city's history, and you can still go in some quarters and still see Pastrick for mayor signs hanging in some windows.
Yeah, speaking of Robert Pastrick, of course, so important and vital to the city of East Chicago. His name actually makes an appearance in the front right corner of the book, Lost East Chicago and Indiana Harbor. We're talking with the author, Joe Peet, who is also, you might know him as, the Times of Northwest Indiana business reporter, an award-winning reporter, I might add, Joe. Let's fast forward a couple of decades here. Of course, one of the biggest stories to come out of East Chicago in the last couple of years, of course, was the West Calumet Housing Project and the Carrie Gosch Elementary School. Of course, that is the lead contamination crisis. And that's still a story that really has not yet been, I guess, finished. It's not been completed. There are still people living in East Chicago who have suffered the health consequences of that lead contaminated soil in that area. What can you tell us about that section of the book?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, that's because the series as a whole is supposed to be about kind of bygone places like, you know, the bygone downtown, Indiana Harbor, jewelry stores, you know, Mademoiselle Shop, Hot Dog John's, Taco Joe's, people, places family remember. That's like the general gist of it. But the thing is with the environmental issues in East Chicago, they're just so notable and so pressing, it's impossible to ignore. So I kind of had to touch upon some of that and address some of that in the book. That in and of itself could really be its own book, because there's this legacy of industrial pollution. Like, industry really helped build up East Chicago. You know, it peaked at around 60,000 people, but it really drove the economy. It, you know, led to all the development. It, you know, a lot of people from East Chicago spread further across Northwest Indiana too. So it really helped drive the region as a whole. But the cost of that and the price of that was that there was an incredible amount of industrial pollution, air, water, soil. You know, you had a lot of haze over East Chicago. You know, the Indiana Harbor section had kind of an acrid smell from the steel mills for a long time. There was a famous instance in the 1950s, I believe it was, when a Chicago Tribune reporter stuck his hand in Lake Michigan in Indiana Harbor, and it came back out completely covered in black tar. You know, before there was an EPA, there was just a widespread amount of pollution. And that led to the kind of the ticking time bomb of the lead crisis that attracted a lot of national attention, particularly after Flint, because it had so many similarities to the Flint lead crisis. But the it, you know, basically resulted in the closure of the elementary school, Terry Calls, and the led to the West Calumet neighborhood entirely being, you know, razed. And people were, an entire neighborhood of people was just relocated over, you know, shut down. The homes were torn down. They're relocated overnight. It's being, like, turned into light industrial development now, something that's not going to have, like, a warehouse or logistics. It's something that's not going to have that pollution. But just hundreds of people were just immediately told they're going to have to leave their home. And there are just unsafe levels of lead in the soil. But that's unfortunately part of the tragic, you know, industrial legacy in the city, where you have all kinds of compounding environmental problems, where it's not, you know, That obviously was a crisis because it can really affect brain development. You know, children in particular are strongly susceptible to even small trace amounts of lead can really impact their development and hurt them neurologically. But they, you know, East Chicago's just dealt with all kinds of, you know, spills into Lake Michigan, toxic emissions, air quality problems. It still has, you know, some of the, like, the worst air quality in the state. It has a lot of, you know, a lot of environmental problems to this time. It's part of the issue, too, with redevelopment, even at a time when development's booming in the region, is you have kind of sites where it's going to need some type of environmental cleanup, which kind of will deter some investors and things like that. Mm-hmm. But communities for generations have had to live with the kind of the toxic, the toxic legacy of these companies.
Joe, as we wrap up our conversation about your book, Lost East Chicago and Indiana Harbor, before I get into sort of the final thoughts, final question, where can folks find the book and maybe get out and meet you?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, the book, it's available at local bookstores like Miles Books and Highland, Green Door Books and Hobart, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. Basically, any local bookstore is going to have it. I'm going to be doing some signings coming up at Miles Books on July 20th, Green Door Books on July 28th, and Paul Henry's Art Gallery in Hammond on August 3rd, I believe. But I'll be out doing book signings, and then I usually give talks to different historic societies, so I'll be out and around discussing the book.
And of course, the final comment here, we talk about current East Chicago Mayor Anthony Copeland. Copeland said, quote, "It's a beautiful thing. People get a twinkle in their eyes when they remember it. Those who grew up here and left often can't find it anywhere else. This book hits a lot on the nostalgia of East Chicago, but as we look forward now, we're in 2024 and moving forward through the next few years, maybe the next few decades, what does the future look like for East Chicago?
East Chicago does seem to be kind of on the upswing. You know, it's been a rough past few decades, but they are making the progress. Like the kind of final chapter looks at a lot of the initiatives of the Copeland administration, things they're doing to kind of stabilize the housing, and they've, you know, torn down and replaced a lot of the public housing in the city already. They're doing things like trying to bring in a new team to Block Stadium. There's been some, you know, investments been coming to the city. There's been, you know, they're diversifying the industrial base beyond just steel mills. But there's been the number of it. You've seen a lot of, like, I've covered a lot of new business openings there for the Times. You've seen a lot of, like, restaurants and retail businesses have come back. The downtown areas are still pretty strong. The city does have, certainly has its challenges. It has challenges that are common with any kind of Rust Belt area or any kind of urban area. And those do affect it. However, you know, they've been making progress on environmental cleanup. They've been cleaning up the Grand Calumet River, was one of the most polluted in the country. They've been doing cleanups to the point where, you know, you have hawks and herons and you have all kinds of birds and fish returning. And, you know, progress is being made in a number of fronts. And, you know, it kind of ends kind of on an optimistic note. You know, there's, you see definite signs of seeds being planted that are really starting to germinate in East Chicago.
Joseph Pete, Northwest Indiana Times business reporter, and of course an award-winning reporter, I might add, and author, joining us here on Originally Speaking, discussing Lost East Chicago and Indiana Harbor. Joe, thank you so much for your time today to go ahead and discuss your newest book. And what's the next page turner we should be looking out for?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I'm working on another one for Reedy Press, which is my other publisher. It's Lost Treasures of Indiana. It's a statewide one. For all my books up to this point have focused on Northwest Indiana. They asked me to do one that was kind of about more of Indiana as a whole. It does, of course, have a lot of Northwest Indiana stories in it, though, because that's where I'm from and that's what I try to capture and represent and, you know, so forth. But it takes a more statewide approach to kind of bygone buildings and institutions and sports stadiums and things across the state. So I'm working on that for them now, and I'm not sure exactly when that's going to come out, but it'll be out sometime in a year or two.
Well, we're looking forward to that. But until then, we've got Lost East Chicago and Indiana Harbor. Joe Pete, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And welcome back to Regionally Speaking. Finances are often an off-limit conversation, especially around the holidays. But this holiday season, Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer is looking to change the narrative by encouraging families to have a financial discussion. That's because Gen X, Millennials, and Gen Z are gearing up to inherit over $80 trillion in the Great Wealth Transfer. And many of these recipients will be receiving generational wealth for the very first time. Without a solid financial plan in place, this new wealth might not be passed down to future generations. Before wealth is lost unnecessarily, Greg states that the holiday season is a great time to get the entire family on the same financial plan. Greg joins us now to discuss ways that we can help protect families from the complexities, frustration, and the loss of funds that can come with an unplanned estate. Greg, as always, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me, Andy.
Absolutely. Greg, you believe families should have financial conversations and that the holidays are an ideal time to have these types of discussions. So let's start with why it is important for families to make time for these conversations during the holidays.
Yeah, you know, Dave, financial conversations with your family, you know, can include several things. It's teaching the younger children, you know, the importance of responsibility surrounding money so that they start to build healthy financial habits at a young age, but also the adult children, you know, conversing with aging parents about what their parents' final wishes are and, you know, all the money discussions in between. So, you know, when discussing family finances, it is smart to include the entire family. So the holidays tend to be a good time since most of the family's together. So if someone is unable to meet in person, it's preferred to have them on, you know, video like Zoom or FaceTime rather than not include them. But having these conversations as early as possible is key to making family members comfortable having these types of talks so that if or when life becomes challenging or family members are more prepared for those difficult conversations.
Greg, I must say that while having financial discussions are in fact important, at the same time, finances can be boring for some. And at the same time, especially around the holidays, they can be quite overwhelming. How can someone start a financial conversation at a family gathering without dampening the mood or the festivities?
Great question, Dee. So while these conversations can be heavy, communication is key for trying to get all the family members on the same page. And for many families, financial conversations are going to take place. It's just a matter of whether the conversation is during a crisis or beforehand, like we're suggesting here, so that the family is prepared for the crisis. So when you think of it from that aspect, it might not seem as heavy, but actually more productive and proactive.
Absolutely agree. And you know, you make an excellent point. So most people, they won't even serve a new recipe for the first time to guests. They'll practice it beforehand. If you won't wing it with a recipe from your kitchen, I would think that you wouldn't wing it with your entire financial house. How should the point person prepare for this conversation?
Well, the family member leading this discussion should decide on the goal of the conversation. You know, is it to just educate the family? Is it to inform them of certain things that are going on? Is it to bring the family together so there's no surprises? Or, you know, what is that goal? And then after deciding on the goal of the conversation, then you can decide if you want to have a third party like a, you know, family lawyer or a financial professional involved who can help guide the conversation. And lastly, just prepare for questions that could arise so that you can address them as the discussions continue.
So we discussed in the opening that having a solid financial plan in place can possibly help with individuals not losing money unnecessarily. What is included in a solid financial plan?
Yeah, financial plan is to help you achieve your financial goals. So it can include other plans, you know, like what is your retirement plan / income plan? What is your estate plan? Do you need a tax plan or what does that look like? And then finally, legacy plan. You know, what are some of the things that are important to me from that standpoint?
Greg, for many families who are having this financial conversation for the first time, the process, quite honestly, can seem daunting. Can the person leading the discussion break down tasks into smaller pieces? And if so, where should individuals start?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's not uncommon for someone not to know where all their assets are. Start by taking an inventory of all the financial assets and where they're located, count numbers, and how to access and all those assets, right? And these can include things like your financial accounts, mortgages, 401ks, other retirement accounts, digital assets. You know, what if you bought Bitcoin or another cryptocurrency but never told anyone? You know, safety deposit boxes, et cetera. Just so everybody's aware of where everything is located and that they're not missing anything.
Absolutely, absolutely. So Greg, Gen X, Millennials, and Gen Zers will be inheriting more than $80 trillion. That's a staggering number in the Great Wealth Transfer. What is so concerning about this transfer of funds, though, I might ask you?
Yep. So like a 20-year study found that 70% of the families lose their wealth by the second generation and 90% lose it by the third generation. And it's just simply loss from poor investment decisions and overspending. What is concerning about this group is that they will inherit this money and move forward in their lives facing a much higher cost of living, inflation, possibly much higher taxes, high home prices, and many of them carry student debt. So you don't have to lose money unnecessarily if you've developed a financial plan.
Now, Greg, that is actually a quite incredible stat. We hear stories about people winning a huge lottery and losing all the money shortly after, and I must say that that's quite heartbreaking. But to lose what your parents or your grandparents worked so hard for and sacrificed for is heart-wrenching. Would taking a financial class be helpful for first-time heirs?
Yes, you know, education is always going to be super helpful in building knowledge on this topic. It all starts with, you know, financial literacy, and it's not just first-time inheritors. We've discussed this on, you know, programs before about people earning substantial income, say $250,000 a year, yet they're living still paycheck to paycheck. So many financial institutions and libraries offer classes. You can read books, or you can make appointments with different professionals in the areas that you have interest in.
Absolutely. So, Greg, I'd like to end our conversation today by saying that I would assume having these conversations help strengthen family bonds. Is that the case?
I believe so. Conversations like these can help strengthen the family bonds, but they can also be tense sometimes. You know, it's not one and done, but it's wise to get started and get the ball rolling. The good news is about 83% of people said talking about the finances helped resolve family money disagreement. And families can be emotional. We know that. So it's smart to encourage family members to move away from making financial decisions based on emotion and move towards a, you know, more strategic way of making these financial decisions that goes back to the financial plan. And this approach allows people to stay proactive rather than reactive to life's unexpected events.
And Greg, you know what? Before I let you go, I forgot I asked you if taking a financial class would be helpful for first-time heirs. And you said not only would it be helpful for first-time heirs, but also for a lot of people, including those that make six figures. If someone was interested in getting information from your organization, where could they find you?
Yeah, there's a bunch of information right on our website that will bring up the different educational events that we do at the libraries, and then, you know, start with libraries. A lot of times you can go to the libraries or these community centers, and they'll post events on their websites as to these educational courses, and sometimes even schools. You know, go to the schools and ask them if they're doing any educational events for topics of interest that are not requiring enrollment. So there's a lot of resources. We are generally doing things all around the area here that we make information available about several different things.
Greg Hammer is the president and CEO of Hammer Financial Group. Greg, as always, I enjoy having you with us because you share so much information to help us all prepare for retirement. And so, again, I thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
As always, Dee, I appreciate it, and thank you for having me.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for this week. Thanks to our guest, and we'll be back with an all-new show next Friday.